I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. The noted academic and author and a previous guest on the program, Thomas Homer Dixon, has edited a new collection of essays, Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. Its contributors discuss these two crises, which need to be solved quickly, that of peak oil and global warming. Joining me now is one of the essayists in the book, Dr. Mark Jackard. He is a professor at Simon Fraser University's School of Resource and Environmental Management and a former member of the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The book is edited with Nick Harrison, and its foreword is written by Ronald Wright. Other contributors include David Hughes of the Geological Survey of Canada, William Marsden, and Jeffrey Simpson, among others, whom Dr. Jackard co-wrote that book last year, Hot Air. The book is published by Random House Canada. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Mark Jackard. Good morning, Professor Jackard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Can you explain what, we've heard this term peak oil. Can you explain what that is exactly?
Peak oil is a recognition of, in many ways, what is obvious, which is that oil is something finite on this earth, so there's a fixed quantity of it. And as you look for something, you develop some techniques to get better at finding it, and so you might find larger and larger quantities. But ultimately, you're starting to look for the smaller deposits of that fixed resource, which is distributed unevenly in nature. And so, if we were to look over time on a graph, we would see finding the oil starting to climb up over time, and we really got interested in oil about 1850, so starting in 1850, this curve starts to go up, and eventually, though, it's getting harder and harder to find oil, and so it starts to curve back down, and so the top of it is the idea of peak oil. And so if we think of global production of oil, our production of oil has gone up generally most years for 150 years or so. And the question is, when will it reach a peak, and when will we start to go down that other side of the curve? Now, when we do go down, what is it, or when we reach the peak, for one thing, or go down, what will be the significance of that? And people who are a little more cataclysmic in their thinking, but I shouldn't say that, but just very concerned, are worried that when we hit the peak and start on the slide down, it will be a sort of a traumatic jolt for society, that, for example, oil prices might skyrocket and stay up there, and that would, in our energy-intensive lifestyles and the way in which we've even built communities or do international trade with food and goods traveling all over the planet, that all of those things will suddenly become very expensive, dispersed living in suburbs and transporting of goods and food. And so that will cause a fairly abrupt and unpleasant transition that we would have to go through. That's the more the worried side of it. And then there's also another side that says, well, maybe, actually the concept of oil is not so simple. It's not just this one thing. We used to not call oil that was off the coast. We call it offshore oil. We used to not call oil oil sands, the oil impregnated sands in Alberta. We used to not call oil heavy oil found in Venezuela. And there are various other ways of making the things we get from oil today, like gasoline and diesel and home heating oil in some places. And so maybe as we start to get to that peak in oil production, in conventional oil production, either A, we'll substitute to other things from oil, different types of oil, or we'll even substitute completely away from oil to biofuels and maybe even running our cars on electricity from wind power. And that can actually happen fairly smoothly.
So I'm trying to understand this. So because in your essay in the book, I was trying to look up the guy's name. He suggested that the peak was going to be in the 70s, right? And people have suggested that it'll be at this time now, right?
Okay, there's Hubert, who became quite famous, King Hubert, was an American geologist, and writing in the mid-50s, 1950s, he predicted that the United States, so the continental United States, not counting Alaska and Hawaii, would reach its peak in about 1973 of oil production and then start to decline. So you're really talking about all the oil in Texas and some in, you know, Louisiana and other states like that. And he was dead on. But, of course, then what happened is, you know, they got oil in Alaska and so on, and, you know, the United States started to import more oil. Now the people who are talking about a peak oil production are really talking about the entire planet. So it's, you know, Hubert developed this idea looking at the fixed continent of the United States, and now the question is, what about the whole planet? When will be the year of peak oil? Now, I just want to counter, though, and say that some people, and they have some pretty good arguments, because I mean, I'm sort of caught in the middle here, will argue that we won't even know when we're at the peak. There's nothing to worry about. I mean, there's always things to worry about, but that, you know, oil prices will go up because of demand, so it's not just the production peak and the availability of substitutes. And so you could have oil prices start to fall before you got to a peak, or they could start to rise dramatically even before you got to the peak. Like, there are all sorts of things like that.
When oil went up last year, people thought it was the peak, didn't they?
Yes, and I happen to be saying that this was more likely a shorter-term development, and that, again, price would not be the thing that tells us we're at the peak. And just looking at the production costs of oil and its unconventional oil, as I just talked about, oil sands and so on, just looking at the literature and the research there and the industry data that's available, I said, well, you know, it could be that the price will stay up around $150, $200, and some people were saying more than that. But I said, there's also a good chance that that price will fall back down to somewhere below $80 because of the cost of these substitutes are not that high. Now, you know, who knows why the price fell as it did. Right now we have conflicting information or possible causes, I guess. One possible cause, and I'm sure it played a role, is the recession that's happened. So that's a dampening back of demand, and so price expectations will fall. But we also had a dampening back of demand as people react to the rising oil prices, which you'd expect, and we had a ramping up of alternative supply. We had huge investments in Canada to expand the production of oil from oil sands. Well, there were similar things going on with offshore oil around the world, with what's called enhanced oil recovery, where you can raise the pressure of a depleted oil well and capture more of the oil that otherwise would have stayed down there and never been extracted. So a whole bunch of things that one would predict would go on did go on, but they're coupled with that recession. The price fell. Those people who think the price will otherwise really be high, such as Jeff Rubin, who's one of the authors and has one of the pieces in the book, his argument is it's the economic recession that's caused the price to fall, whereas someone like myself would say, yeah, I'm sure the recession had a role, but there were a whole bunch of other reasons, as I just mentioned, that would also cause the price to not, it would make it hard to support a high price like $150 a barrel that we had in mid-2008.
You answer the question in the book, how much fossil energy is left in the ground, and you answer it by saying that there's a lot. And then you have something that says that if consumption levels stay the same, there's enough oil, fossil fuel, that for 67 years, that's just the reserve. That's the...
That's the conventional oil.
Yeah.
When you realize that we can make oil products from coal and from natural gas, then you're looking at hundreds of years at today's consumption levels.
So it's your contention then, because you've become sort of an election issue, you've entered the fray, I should say, that we should promote projects as they do in Qatar, where natural gas is turned into synthetic gas, or in South Africa where they use coal.
No. I don't believe in promoting anything.
No.
There's one thing I believe in promoting, which is aggressive policy on greenhouse gas emissions. And I believe that wherever the biggest threat today to the environment, to the planet, from energy use. But I also believe that there are localized threats everywhere. So, for example, I'm a strong advocate of very stiff regulation of oil sands development, and I'm not satisfied with how they're developing the oil sands these days, and that's not even talking about greenhouse gas emissions. So myself, I support a moratorium on any more oil sands plants, in my case, especially because of greenhouse gas emissions, though. And I don't really advocate anything other than that we need stronger environmental policies. But what I do point out in my chapter, and this is a conundrum for the peak oil people who, you know, sort of see a high price of oil around every corner. If we are successful, if humanity is successful in starting to seriously address the risk of climate change, it means that we're going to have a rising price on greenhouse gas emissions. And it might come from a carbon tax. It might come from cap and trade. I don't care about that either. I don't care which one it is. I do care that we have a price on greenhouse gas emissions. Well, ironically, if we do that, that's going to decrease and dampen the demand for oil, the demand for coal. In some cases, people will figure out how to use coal and oil and capture the carbon dioxide and make electricity or hydrogen, something that we can use cleanly. But it's going to dampen the demand for those, and those will help to drive the price down. So, I mean, if you believe we're going to have a high price for oil, then I'm assuming you either don't understand economics or you believe we're going to do nothing about climate change, and maybe that's true.
The idea of we need to address both crises, climate change and peak oil, do you have to do one instead of the other? Can you do both in concert?
Right. So I think this is always the fun of getting one of the contributors to a collective book to make a comment on it. So I want to be careful because Thomas Homer Dixon is a good friend of mine. We share a lot of the same ideas about the world, and I really like the work he does. And so I was thrilled to contribute to this book. But if you were to read, for example, his introductory section and then read my section, you'd probably see that we do differ on this one.
Right.
So his argument would be that we do need to deal with both issues. I think his argument, in fairness, his argument would be we need to deal with both issues. We've got to worry about peak oil, and we've got to worry about climate change. And I guess my position is more that we've got to worry about climate change. You know, I think that you'll always get price spikes in energy. I think that the price of conventional oil will trend upward, but I don't think it's going to be at $150 or $250 a barrel as a sustained average over the next 10 to 15 years. I would see its average price as being much, much lower than that. Who knows, $80, whatever. But I can never predict a spike that might happen from one year to the next, and I wouldn't trust anyone who did predict that. So anyway, my point is that no, I would argue that we need to address the climate issue, and as the point I made to you earlier, I think in addressing that, you actually wipe away the peak oil problem as well, because you're less and less interested in getting oil and burning it.
Right. So how do we address the climate change issue?
We need to basically constrain or cap our emissions of greenhouse gases globally. It's going to have to start with the rich countries, but I'm doing work with the Chinese government right now, and they're more and more sensitive to the fact that we're not going to allow them to destroy the planet while we're taking action. And that's why if you look at like the bills that have been put forward in the United States and even the most recent ones, they talk about, you know, if China and India and other countries are not also taking actions to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions seriously, then their imports will have to pay a tariff, you know, related to emissions and so on. There will be trade pressures to get the whole planet to work together on this, because we have to do it all together. It's a global problem, and it has to require a global solution. So what it will be is a constraint that will show up as a rising price for sort of everything you buy that involves emissions. So let's say the price of gasoline over the next 25 years in Canada, wherever, will rise relative to the price of electricity from zero emission sources that you could put in your car, a plug-in hybrid, of some of the biofuels if they're made in ways that are not threatening our agricultural production, maybe from other, you know, cellulosic wood fiber and other things. So some biofuels, some electricity, perhaps hydrogen produced again in zero emission ways. And so and I'm just using the car as an example, it's not like from today to tomorrow we all start buying different cars. It's that the technologies we use, the equipment stocks, the buildings we're in, the factories that we have, slowly evolve because of a rising price for one of the options. That is an option to burn fossil fuels. So instead of your furnace burning natural gas, more and more people will be getting what we call a heat pump that runs off electricity and extracts heat from the ground. That's the way we'll solve this problem.
So do you see that in British Columbia compared to other Canadian provinces that we're doing this sort of stuff? I mean, we have the carbon tax here. Is that working?
Right. This is we'll know that it's working in about the year 2025. Now, I'm being a bit facetious, but what I've been trying to say is you need to start now with small changes that lead to changes in the price of fuels. Now, myself, the carbon tax is probably the best policy in the world right now. Myself, if I was advising a politician, and I've never been involved in advising Gordon Campbell on policy, I would have probably said, do a cap and trade. And we will be evolving into a cap and trade. Gordon Campbell's government has implemented legislation for a cap and trade, and you can fold the carbon tax into that. That's what the Norwegians are doing right now as they merge into the European system, and so are the Danes and the Swedes. So this distinction between carbon tax and cap and trade is really a false distinction, but you do have to have emissions pricing, and both of those will provide that. And you need to cover as many emissions as possible. So what I think is more important is that Gordon Campbell's carbon tax covers 75% of our emissions, whereas it's very sad for me to see the NDP trying to win the election by telling us, oh, you know what, we can get there by eliminating the carbon tax, and then we'll put a cap and trade, which is emissions pricing, only on BC industry, and that'll be 35% of emissions. And then they claim, and we'll still get emissions down by the same 33% below the current level. So with the current levels of emissions in BC, Gordon Campbell has set a target for 2020 to have our emissions reduced by a third. The NDP says that they can achieve that as well without carbon pricing, without emission pricing for you and I when we drive a car, heat our home, and so on. They say we can just do it all in the backs of industry. Well, what I do is computer models about how economies function with different kinds of environment and energy policies, and when I simulate that and I show it to colleagues around the world, they're not surprised when I show that if we actually did try to achieve that that reduction with the NDP approach of just hitting industry, you would lose a lot of jobs in British Columbia. I estimate about 60,000 job losses over the next 12 years because you'd simply put the cost of production out of reach for our industries to be competitive.
But you did advise Gordon Campbell on something, right? Not on policy necessarily, but you were part of a panel, were you?
Yeah, no, I've never advised Gordon Campbell, never met him. This is just something that the NDP keeps saying over and over again. I was appointed, I've tried to stay out of the British Columbia situation. I'm the co-chair of a task force for the Chinese government, as I said. Here in British Columbia, I finally reluctantly agreed to be an advisor to the Climate Action Team. That was a group of sort of experts and citizens. I don't know, there was about 15 people. None of them were politicians, or none of them were provincial politicians. I think there was a mayor among the group. And what they were doing was in an open public process, separate from Gordon Campbell, the cabinet, the Cabinet Committee on Climate, anyone like that. They met in Vancouver, and I was there 6 times as their advisor. And eventually they issued a public report in July that was then made public to British Columbians and to I guess the government, the premier as well. And it's ironic, but that's identical to the role I played 11 years ago for the NDP when they created a citizens committee, and I was the advisor to that citizens committee. So it's been disappointing to me. I mean, I don't see how the NDP were not calling me the advisor to Gordon Campbell when I've been so critical of him for the last 6 years on climate policy.
Nationally, do we see anything? I mean, do you see anything that's good policy, and also the United States?
I think that I'm very critical of what's going on nationally in Canada. I'm a member of the National Roundtable, which is again an advisory body, in this case to the federal government. It means I've never met with Stephen Harper or any of the ministers, but this is a group of we're about 20 people selected from across the country. It's a three-year appointment, and it's not on climate per se. It's on environmental concerns, but actually we've been almost totally focused on climate for the last 3 years. And we, that body, just released a report just earlier, in the past week, maybe it's a week ago, that if you look on the website, National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy, if you Google them, then you'd see this report, and I really invite people to read the executive summary. And in there, what we basically say is what I've just said to you. We say we need a great advance in our climate policies in British Columbia. It can be a carbon tax or a cap and trade. We end up saying we recommend that the government go ahead with a cap and trade system because we think the Americans will do that. But, you know, we're not favoring it over a carbon tax. And what we say in there is that emission coverage has to be economy-wide. And now our federal conservative government right now has a policy that's going to come into force that caps emissions for industry, but it just industry, but it doesn't really cap them. They can avoid the cap by paying you and I to buy a more efficient car or insulate our homes and so on. And those kind of things, it turns out, are not very effective. When we insulate our home, we renovate it and make it a little bigger and so on. So, but you asked me elsewhere in the world, and yes, if you look at the bills that are coming forward in the United States, and that's why I was just down at Stanford University yesterday. I'm part of a group of six modeling teams that are modeling the U.S. policy, not directly for the government, but as part of, again, a sort of a broader public education kind of process. And there, I'm very impressed with the drafts of these policies. Nothing's been, you know, passed final readings or anything like that. But they're policies that would put a cap and trade on the entire economy, which is just like having a carbon, just like having Gordon Campbell's carbon tax.
You know, we've talked for a while now, and this is just one essay in the book. This is a fascinating conversation, Dr. Jeckard, and congratulations on the book and your colleagues on putting it together. It's an interesting and necessary one, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Carbon Shift, How the Twin Crises of Oil Depletion and Climate Change Will Define the Future. It's published by Random House Canada. Thomas Homer Dixon and Nick Harrison are the editors. Joining me now as a contributor, Dr. Mark Jeckard on the line. I'm Joseph Plante.